You are tuning into the Breaking Ground podcast, the voice of the geotechnical industry. On this episode, we'll be discussing history, product innovation, and technical developments in the piling sector with two of its best. Stay tuned to learn more just after this message from our sponsors.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board, and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical, and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant, and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Hello and a very warm welcome to the Breaking Ground podcast. My name is Steve Hadley. I'm the chair of the Federation of Piling Specialists. You might be familiar with the podcast I hosted for the FPS. Well, the Breaking Ground podcast will be more of the same, but hopefully with a wider reach and support. I'll be talking to some prominent geo industry people about a range of topics, including sustainability, design, commerce, and STEM. If you work in the industry or perhaps you're thinking about joining, then there will be something for you. I'd like to thank the Ground Forum for their support of this podcast. They are an umbrella body for the industry, and they've got trade associations such as the British Geotechnical Association, the British Drilling Association, of course, the FPS, the AGS, and the Geological Society amongst their membership. Also, Ground Engineering Magazine will be helping provide some content and guests, as well as promoting the podcast online and in their magazine. It's a little ironic that the first edition of this new podcast should actually focus on piling itself, but hopefully that does provide some continuity for our regular listeners. We're going to be discussing some of the details of the Piling 2020 conference that was held recently. We want to give you a taste for what went on if you weren't there, and for those that did attend, give you some extra bits of detail that you might have missed, particularly from some of the additional papers in the proceedings that weren't presented at the event. Well, let's meet our guests. We've got Yvonne Ainsworth, Director of Gavin and Doherty Geosolutions, who was the event organiser, and Martin Pedley, Managing Director at GSS Piling, who was, like myself, one of the keynote speakers. Hello both, how are you?
Hi, afternoon.
Great to have you with me on this first edition. I'll come to you first, Yvonne. Can you tell us a little bit more about the conference, how it was formed, the people behind it and the intention of it?
Yes, sure, Steve. Apart from organising the Piling 2020 conference that didn't actually happen in 2020, I am also involved with the BGA committee, the BGA being the British Geotechnical Association. In 2016, we decided that we wanted to introduce a biannual conference, and the first conference that the BGA organised was Chalk 2018. Which was a great success. It was held in London, and after the event, we decided that we wanted to, or during the planning, actually, we decided that we wanted to keep that a regular thing. So 2 years later, we wanted to have another one, and the decision was made that it should be on the topic of piling. Hence, we decided it was Piling 2020, which was great, and I was asked to get involved, and that was fantastic. And then, obviously, COVID came and had its effect in 2020, so it became Piling 2020 in 21.
Yeah, I know you're quite determined for a while to make it an in-person conference, but yes, I've got to say, it still worked really well virtually. In fact, possibly even more effective in certain ways.
I think we all were hoping for personal contact. So because the BGA is a charity, so we try to arrange things for as cheaply as possible. We don't have to make a profit. We're not a commercial organization. So we were hoping for cheap tickets, which for delegates, which meant that we needed sponsorship, which makes it a bit more tricky in the virtual world, because exhibitors do live on the basis that they need to have foot people coming and talking to them and shaking hands, which all wasn't possible.
Yeah, and who was the conference saying that in terms of individuals? So you had the BGA themselves, a mixture of consultants and contractors, but they had the support of the FPS, of course. What sort of levels, how academic would you describe the conference?
The conference was aimed to have a good mixture of people, consultants, contractors, as well as academics, so practitioners and academics, to bring everyone together to produce networking and a knowledge exchange of what the academics are doing, but at equal terms, inform the academics what the practitioners are doing. So it was all aimed at enhancing of best practice and bringing the piling industry to the next level.
Yeah, that diversity in the type of people I think is reflected in just the keynote speakers, for instance. We've got academics, consultants, contractors represented there. So I actually had the honour of starting the conference in terms of being the first speaker. Was that by design or alphabetical order? What was the
For once, it didn't go in alphabetical order. I think I would have failed miserably there. But no, I think it was extremely important to have a variety of keynotes. So we were debating quite a while on who we'd invite as keynote speakers for such a conference. And I've done a lot of work with you in the past, Steve, so I know how passionate you feel about the industry in terms of people, not necessarily the alphas and the CUs, if you like, but the key asset that our industry has of people and how we keep them and how we encourage them and how we keep them safe. So when we finally decided on the keynote speakers and all the keynotes had agreed, then it was clear that we should start with you talking about your keynote to open up the conference just when everyone is tuned in and listening and keen and eager to go and they pay a lot of attention. So it was chosen deliberately.
That's great to hear, and obviously personally, it was great for me to be able to do that. But more importantly, the topics I think are so crucial. So my paper was about how we're at a moment where we can create a more equitable, healthy, and viable industry, and seize upon this opportunity that we have right now with the influx of work, particularly from HS2. But also from the bounce back from Brexit and the bounce back from COVID, where we're going to see a real surge in the volume of work happening. And rather than just simply go out there and say, right, let's all make more profit for our organisations, let's see if we can create a better industry that is fairer and looks after our people in a different way. So it was fantastic to be able to do that. I don't want to spend too much time talking about that paper now. Those sort of topics will be discussed more in the future. But also, if you want to go back to any of the FPS podcasts, there is a lot of the different episodes that do talk about diversity in the industry, mental health, a lot of the topics that were covered in my presentation itself. So please go and have a listen if you haven't done so already. And moving on to some of the other keynotes, I had a really interesting one from Byron Byrne, and his topic was about offshore wind turbines and particularly the lateral pile design of those. And the market I see for offshore is becoming bigger and bigger, and you've only got to look at the numbers of wind turbines going up and the costs of them. I was pulling some figures off the internet when I was doing my research. There's the Dogger Bank wind farm off the coast of Yorkshire. It's got 2,800 wind turbines going up. Now, each one of these it powers 16,000 homes, and it's as big as the Eiffel Tower. Now, they pick these locations because relatively shallow depth to the seabed, but the forces that get put onto these wind turbines are huge. Martin, I know that this was a paper that provoked a bit of interest for you. What things sort of stood out from Byron's presentation?
Personally, I find it very interesting to read, because most of my career has been spent on shore looking at relatively small diameter piles, if you like, up to maybe 2.5 meters or something like that. But when you look at it offshore, it's just so different. The conditions which they're installing the piles, you know, the loadings, I mean, you touched on the fact the loadings are very complicated. And, as I say, the scale of some of the piles, I mean, you know, currently we're putting piles in which are 8 to 10 meters in diameter. You know, they've got 30 to 50 meters of embedment, with rotors at 160 meters in diameter. And these are going to get bigger. You know, they're talking about going up to, I think it was 12 to 14 meters in terms of the... So the actual piles themselves are huge. They're like almost the structures that we put on top of some of our piled solutions, Steve. So I find that quite fascinating. But then when you start to look at how they're physically loaded with the tide... Both you've got a combination of the tide as well as the wind acting on them. And because they have a relatively shallow embedment to what we see on the laterally loaded piles onshore, the effects are very different. And I think, you know, although some of the theories that have been used in the past have been applied to these wind farms and or the design of the wind farms, they're not really relevant. So there's been this whole, really in Byron's presentation, on keynote paper, he talked very much about a couple of major research programs, the first being the PISA program, which was a collaboration of several universities, Oxford University, Imperial, I think it was also University College Dublin, and the Carbon Trust was involved, as well as a lot of the wind farm developers. So it's a truly collaborative piece of work, because actually the industry needs it as these structures get bigger and older as well. So we design them for their longevity. So that was quite interesting, because the first stage of it, or the PISA project, was looking at really just understanding the loading and monotonic loading. And then there was a second piece of work, which I think was called Picasso. And that was really looking at what happens when you have this cyclic loading and the long-term impacts and how that affects the geotechnical capacity, or what level of geotechnical capacity you use before... shall we say, that the structures potentially become unserviceable. So I really sort of found it quite interesting, the fact that they'd done all, you know, they'd obviously been looking at what's happened out in the field and some of the existing design methods. They'd then gone on and done laboratory trials as well as finite element analyses. They developed it was a relatively simple tool compared with using 3D finite element analysis, you know, but a tool that could be used to dimension the structures in various ground conditions. But at the same time, they'd done some field trials, you know, and again, putting in 2 meter diameter tubes and laterally loading them is quite complicated. So it was really sort of quite interesting to see the trials they'd done in Cowden in Yorkshire, and the other trials in Dunkirk, which were being done in Sands.
So well, that was great, wasn't it? That video that they had showing the oscillations of the jacks to simulate the cyclic loading from the wind, and it showed the so you basically had two monopiles installed, and that these aren't full size, they're probably quarter size.
I think piles. They were two meters diameter, and they did have some, which one reaction one that was larger, but they were large by, you know, by any standards, they were large structures, to test, and you know, it was fantastic seeing it.
And yeah, the investment in that must have been huge, but I suppose that because there's so much money going into this, if it improves your knowledge, that investment is well worth it, because it could save a meter or so in terms of the installation depth, which could be a fortune
The reality is, once you send your ship out, or however they physically put them in the ground with all of your tubes on, you can't afford for it to not work that effectively. It's not easy to do any kind of remedials or upgrades. And I think there was actually one of the statistics in the paper was something like 20% of the cost of these wind farms is actually in the foundations. So relative to what we do onshore, It's a very large sum of money. So, you know, it's good to see that research is being done, you know, not just in the laboratory or you know, it's actually being done out in the field as well. So, you know, I mean, I think just to sort of summarize on that bit, Steve, I mean, the thing I find fascinating about it, you know, as I say, I didn't really know anything about offshore wind farms. I still don't, I'll be honest. But as a geotechnical engineer, you start to appreciate some of the other challenges. And I'm sure some of the research that's been done as well is just as relevant to onshore work as well.
I think what's great about doing that sort of scale of testing, they're able to correlate it with the model that the computer model that they've developed, and like you say, that you can probably draw parallels to the onshore work. Of course, wind's going to be a big part of the route to zero carbon wind power, geothermal power as well, and the next presentation from Lydia Zakrovich from Imperial College, her focus was more on geothermal piles and termed it the numerical modelling of thermoactive piles. So she was focusing on how the stresses were developed from the heat going through the piles. I'm not going to spend really any time discussing that paper. It's there, and it was a really interesting lecture, and hopefully people can find that. But the next edition of this podcast will actually be a focus on geothermal energy and including geothermal piles. So we'll be able to hear from some experts in that field. Of course, Martin, your keynote presentation was around reflecting on the conference itself, which is quite a challenge, a similar sort of challenge to what we've got today in terms of looking back to what went on. Now, we will clearly cover lots of the things that you discussed in your reflections over the course of the next hour or so. But I know that you also had a dedication within your presentation to David Greenwood.
Yeah, so David Greenwood unfortunately passed away last year. I met him, was it 1988, when I was doing my DPhil at Oxford, and he came and lectured about grouting, and I found it absolutely fascinating. And I maintained contact with him, and actually ended up working for David for many years. And he was a great mentor. And I know he was the same to many other people as well. But he was a geologist by degree training, and was very much involved. His career started very much involved in ground improvement and grouting. But he was one of those individuals who had so much enthusiasm for all areas of our industry. And I think you started off earlier talking about people, because actually he was a very people sort of focused person as well. And I certainly benefited from that. And he was very generous with his time. And he sort of really transcended, although he was a practitioner, very much a practitioner, he transcended all the way through from sort of research through to, you know, installation and design through to, you know, codes and standards. And so he was an incredibly enthusiastic individual. And I think, you know, that's reflected in the fact that he got the Skempton Medal. I can't remember which year it was, but some time ago. And I just felt it was an appropriate conference, because really the conference, you know, it had a wide audience, and it was all the things that David was very much enthusiastic about. So I just felt it was appropriate to sort of remember David's contribution, and, you know, both as an individual and as a caring human being, as well as somebody who actually contributed a huge amount to, you know, the knowledge and that we use in our daily lives.
Yeah, quite right. Well, in a technical industry, you know, it's really important to be able to clearly communicate that message at what we hope to do today, at the most basic level that we can, so as many people as possible can understand it. And it sounds like David was really effective in doing that. I'm going to start now talking about some of the other papers, and I want to start, I think it's quite a good place to start, with one of my favourite papers in the proceedings, and one of my favourite presentations from it, and that was at the piling in London. Now, I'm sorry, I don't have all the first names, and it always feels really rude, and I don't know why academics do it, but they always reference the surname. So Mr. Rutty, sorry that I don't know your first name. Peter, is it? Peter. Okay, great. So Peter explains a bit about the history of piling. Yvon, do you want to just walk us through some of the topics that Peter discussed?
Yeah, sure. I agree with you. It was a very interesting one because obviously we the people who are involved in piling started at some point in your career, and you know what has happened since you started, but you don't necessarily know what's happened beforehand. So every now and again you get a glimpse of it, but Peter had the perfect opportunity to do some research on the history of piling in London. So it might be slightly different in other places, but so what he does in his paper, he looks at the age of the building and the ground conditions, and he's and the height of the building as well, and from there he derives whether or not piles were actually the common thing. So obviously piles didn't always exist. We didn't have anything until the late 19th century when we started seeing some of the structures being built with concrete driven piles. They were powered by steam, and they're probably expected to have found it in the terrace gravels because we didn't have enough power to go there. Now it's very rare these days that anything stops in the terrace gravels of what we do. And from then on, we went into the 1950s. And in 1954, he takes us to the first tripod pile being used and installed into the London clay. And pretty much until the 1990s, all the piles that were drilled and bored were restricted to just staying within the London clay. So everything below the London clay was a bit too scary to touch. And I think people probably have tried and got water coming in and the ground collapsing and said, no, we don't touch this material. We don't understand it. We'll stick up, stay above. So following on from the tripod piles, we got into the board piles and we got into the mechanical devices of building piles. And we started getting into underreams and the like as well, but all still staying within the London clay because nobody wanted to dare to go into any other material. It's only in the later 1990s that we started getting into the sanded sands and the chalk.
They did it by board techniques, but with drilling fluid. So
dry. Well, the sanded sands piles, yes. Before that, obviously, everything they tried to keep it dry. One thing to note is the first C of A pile was built in 1966 by Simplex Piling at the time. And I think a lot has evolved since then. And C of A piling has obviously become a lot more popular than it was in the 1960s. But it's quite impressive to read up on these developments. And I think when you read Peter's paper, it's some of it goes without saying, but like the logic to it, like if it's a fairly limited height, it's likely to be founded on good competent gravel, you know, rather than needing piles. But I think the interesting one is also that people have, with time and maybe in the 20th century, have become more scared of using shallow foundations. And because piles have been reduced in cost and are really quick to install now with the development of the C of A piles, we've gone away from putting seven-story buildings on pad foundations into the terrace gravels and would rather pile it just to be safe. So there's some food for thought there of whether or not people in the 19th century were just a bit braver or more ignorant. It probably depends on your viewpoint there.
Well, it could come down to money, it could come down to risk. I think a lot of the time I see buildings being piled because perhaps structural engineers don't want to take responsibility for the shallow foundations and would rather pass the risk on to piled contractors. I mean, it does reduce the risk. There's no two ways about it, and it's clearly defined through warranties and so on where that lies. And of course, Rutty's paper, one of the benefits from it, and the reason I suppose it was commissioned, if you like, is because of Crossrail 2 and the trying to understand how deep foundations might be under buildings and therefore where you could possibly put the line of the new tunnels for Crossrail. So it, it, it's interesting, but actually it's also an extremely useful document for that particular project.
I agree.
Now let's look at a bit more about the design of piles, and I'm going to start out with, like all geotechnical projects, the information. So the quality of information. Now, Derek Egan and et al. And Derek's actually mentioned this a few times in the past about the quality of ground investigation. I think what his paper does really well is it explains how either poor quality or poor quantity ground investigation can start to affect the design of piles, the factors of safety involved. And really, it puts an emphasis on all of us working in the industry to have conversations with our clients about the quality of SI. And I know there's a lot of work going on, but what it does within the paper is illustrates really well how the design line can be manipulated if you've only got a small number of results. And certainly if you end up going lower bound on a small number of results, you could end up extremely conservative. And actually, if you go medium or upper bounds, it could go the other way, and you end up with a design that simply isn't safe. So I found that good, and I think it provides a good context for the design approaches that we're going to go on to discuss. There was actually a couple of conflicting papers. Not all of these were presented at the conference, but when you go into the proceedings, you'll see more about it. So there's been a lot of conjecture, Yvonne and Martin, but I've worked in the foundation industry long enough to know that the alpha value, which, so for those that aren't familiar, the alpha value is an adhesion factor that we use within board pile design. And some people have it as low as 0.3, others 0.6 or even higher, and certainly for driven piles it's higher. So you relate the cohesion of the ground to the skin friction by making a reduction according to how much the soil is going to be softened, and it's all derived from testing. Now, there was a paper by Chandler at JRL Civil Engineering who back analyzed prelim load test and proved that an alpha value of 0.6 was okay, which I'm sure, and we've all been able to achieve alpha values of at least that in the past, those that work in the industry. I would agree that it is possible, but I do think, and I'll be interested to hear the views of our panel here, the risks involved in that, particularly now that we have lower factors of safety under Eurocode. So if you've got preliminary pile testing and working piles, you could end up with, depending on the split between dead and live load, you could end up with a global factor of safety of less than 1.7. And when you consider that you've also got working test piles that are loaded to 1.5 times and possibly a specification requirement to achieve less than 20 millimetres settlement, at 1.5 times, you don't need a lot of ground variability to actually be compromising the potential performance at working load. To a certain extent, that was borne out by the paper by Summersgill et al., which was analysis of pile capacity and revised design following the failure of some working load pile tests. Now, I don't know what site it's from. They've not published the particular location. But in some instances, they were finding that the piles were failing at 1.5 times working load. So they had done an expendable load test in advance, and that performed well. But when it came to the working load test, they actually had 6 load test failures, which, as you can imagine, created quite a problem, and they ultimately ended up with another 60 piles on the job to achieve the capacities that they needed. Interestingly, the conclusion that Summerskill came to was that that was possibly related to the construction technique that they were using. So some of the ones that failed were constructed using segmental augers. There was restricted headroom. And it was concluded that the time of the bore or the construction method meant that the shafts were softer than using larger equipment, and that led to the reduced alpha value and reduced par performance. So I think the lesson there for me is, yes, higher alpha values are possible, but you really need to evaluate the potential variability in the ground and in the construction method.
Yeah, I mean, I think you made the point quite clearly there. You know, the alpha values, it's not a magic number. It's not a single number. It is about, the recipe you use, if you like, to make your piles. You know, how are you drilling the piles? What's the duration of them? Do you really understand the ground conditions? Have you got enough data? You know, that's as important as anything. So, you know, alpha is a range, and you'll always get a range. Some of it's to do with the ground, some of it's to do with the method of construction. And I think that's where, you know, well, we would always argue about using a specialist to understand that. But I think there's also the point that, you know, the factors that exist in codes, they're not magic numbers. You know, just applying a factor to a design line doesn't always give you a pile that performs in the way that you would want it to. So I think, you made the points there, but it is about understanding every site is going to be different, and actually making sure you've got the right strategy to verify that the piles are going to perform. So I think there was some, and I liked both of those papers. And I also, you referred to the paper by Egan, how actually two sites very close to each other had quite different pile lengths from design. Mm-hmm. And, this is where the expertise is really needed when you commission a design. You know, even in, I think everybody thinks London clay is a simple material and well understood, but the reality is it's not as well understood as we like to think it is.
Well, papers like these are going to add to the industry's knowledge, and really the conference just brings all that to the fore. Another area, Thanet Sand. There's some good papers on Thanet Sand. Again, a soil probably even less well understood than clay, but I think there's been a feeling that, oh, actually we can get the piles to perform really well in that material. But when you look at the textbooks, there's not necessarily enough information to support some enhanced bearing capacities and shaft friction values. And so you end up back analysing preliminary test pile data to try and demonstrate it, which isn't easy. And you've still got to get building control and so on to accept those parameters. So that can sometimes lead to inefficiencies within the design. So the paper by Gretland and Hard, I think it could be quite useful for all of us in terms of saying, well, here's some results. Here's the our experience of working in Thanet Sands, and there were CFA piles constructed, and these are the bearing capacities, and they were talking of over 200 kPa in terms of the skin friction, which is in excess of most values that we tend to use for skin friction in sands. Sticking in the east of London, there was also a paper by I think the Arabs team, so Morrison, Ganesharatnam and Barker, and they were talking more around how the piles are constructed and potential risks with getting imperfections within the piles. And I've not had this dialogue, and I've not really seen this suggestion in the past, but there seems to be a concern within that group around how, when we're using an auger extension to construct CFA piles, there's the potential for voids being created, or at least soil falling into the piles. Have either of you come across that particular argument in the past or understand the nuances of that problem?
Yes, is the answer. So, I mean, obviously, when you want to construct a CFA pile, you want to stick to preferably the pile links that you can get onto your auger. So the auger extension to push the augers into the ground is just to get further depths. And that is probably driven by the requirement to go a little bit deeper, to be cutting edge, to be better or deeper than other people. So, but it does create problems. It does, the problem that is mentioned in the paper that you're talking about, Steve, is only one of them. Pulling up a crater and having platform collapses and other bits and are just another side effect. But one of the points I'd like to make, especially with this paper, I think one of the things that engineers do forget is that Mother Nature didn't know that engineers wanted straight lines and uniform values. And Mother Nature did what Mother Nature wanted to do when it developed all the ideology around everywhere. So, which means that while Chandler's paper talks about an alpha value of 0.6, that is in West London, where the clay has got certain properties. Now, if you go to East London, the London clay will be completely different and sometimes doesn't exist at all. So I think that's also worth considering. And even like Martin said, that London clay, we call it London clay. There is so much variation within the London clay of depending where you are that I think we need to just allow ourselves to treat it as different elements and different parts within London. And the more you do, the more work you do, the better you will understand the material and therefore justify the range of parameters that I have used. I mean, this alpha value, alpha was treated like it is meaningless in some point because all you want is you want to know how well the concrete sticks to the soil. And that's a KPA value, ultimately. So it doesn't matter where you put your design line because you just need to match your alpha accordingly. So the combination of alpha and CU needs to have the right value. And that comes in certain parts of London with experience. And that's from back analysing it.
Yeah, so it shows the value of testing, doesn't it? As well as local knowledge, as Martin said, an experienced contractor, not just experience in terms of years, but in the vicinity of the site to understand what's going on and how other piles are performed on nearby.
Yeah, I mean, just jumping in there. I mean, it was one of the comments I made earlier about how you drill a pile makes a difference. And I think that, you know, the paper by Morrison or Paul Morrison and everyone was, it did talk about the instrumentation because it was very much focused on CFA piles. And, you know, you can get two identical drilling machines, two different drivers, and the way they install that pile is completely different. And what we know is when you're drilling into much tougher material, if you've got less power on your machine, you'll use more revolutions. That has an impact on the skin friction that you'll see. The other problem you get is if you have a very powerful machine, you know, you bore it in so tight and you can get this great performance, but you can't necessarily replicate it everywhere because if there's local variations in the ground, and you'll probably be aware, Steve, you know, of the number of people who've actually lost augers trying to drill into the
sand. I was going to say, can you get it out?
It's like a limpet on a lump of rock at the end of the day. So, you know, we've all had those embarrassing moments, but it would have been a pretty good pile if you could have formed it.
Yeah,
so. You know, I think Yvonne's absolutely right. I mean, the ground varies absolutely everywhere. There's really nowhere where it's completely homogeneous. You know, we have these idealized design models. But I mean, that's why we need, you know, we need to have sensible factoring and good test data so that we can, you know, we can establish the design parameters. There's no magic there, that's for sure.
Yeah. And whilst Paul Morrison talks about a lot of variations in people and the drilling techniques and the powerful machines that we have and everything else, there's still more and other factors to consider. For example, the teeth configuration on the auger itself, which will create certain things. The wear blocks, or do we just weld on hard facing on the sides that he barely touches upon, and other aspects, the spacing, the inclination of the flights, the distance between the flights, and things that work in certain parts in London don't work in other parts of London. And yet we're drilling the same clay, or we're drilling the same Thanet sands, or we're drilling the same rock. I mean, we can take it even out of London. And CFA piling is more common, is now continued to be used in drilling of weak rocks. And sometimes an auger will work and sometimes it doesn't. And yet using the same machine and using the same auger that worked 10 kilometers away, but it doesn't work now. So why is that? And it's probably that there's even more research to be done or to be documented on the fracture spacing, on the quality of the rock, on the hardness of the rock, you know, on the infill of the fractures and the like in let's say Manchester, whether or not you can or can't drill something with CFA. Mm-hmm. So I think people, yes, machines, yes, auger configuration, yes, teeth configuration, and then ground conditions. And that's probably not even all of the influencing factors. It makes it pretty hard to come to a uniform conclusion.
Yeah. I'll jump back in there if I may. I mean, one of the points you made there, we were talking about London earlier and I made the comment, everyone thinks it's known conditions. And we do have a lot of information in and around London, so we should be wiser than we are. But what I thought was really good about the conference, there were probably four or five different papers about piling in Sherwood sandstones and what used to be the Kuiper Marl, and which was really good to start getting a bit more information about some of the regional geology. But it also shows the amount of development that's going on in and around the country, and probably we're going to see the importance of the ground investigation as we start to put up more complex or more highly loaded structures. And we're putting piles into geologies that we don't have that same degree of experience. And I think Yvonne's right. There's a lot of weak rocks, and weak rocks are notorious in terms of setting design parameters. And, so I think, the golden rules, have good ground investigation, think carefully about it and make sure that you've got a drilling technique that allows you to form the pile.
Yeah, I agree. It's challenging to identify the right parameters within rock. There was papers about, I think there's one in Cardiff and Birmingham, and there's more and more obviously related to HS2 coming up in Birmingham. And we started out the conversation talking about the development within London and sort of the types of foundations and the types of structures that were created through the centuries, and how the foundation techniques had to develop in accordance with the type of property demands. And really what we're seeing is that replicated across the country now, as you get higher rise structures in other parts of the UK. We'll start to see more complex techniques, those locations too. Before we move away from design, one other paper that I do want to highlight is around the reuse of foundations, and there is a good case study there again from an Arabs team, Taylor Shields and Patel, around the Triton Square project. And so they talk through their approach to analysing existing pile foundations and how they could be utilised within a redevelopment of that building. And I think we'll see more and more of that. In fact, it's only Tuesday this week that I went to a site, and they were using the majority of the foundations under a tower block. So it's an 8-story tower block, and they were adding another 2 stories on top, and they wanted some supplemental piles, and there'd be a couple of lift shafts. So I think our understanding of the processes behind that are going to be more important. And, we've got to provide that comfort to our customers and our insurers and lots of other interested parties. Let's have a look now about efficiency within the construction technique and the materials. The Kelprey put forward a couple of papers. One of those was on zero cement use. Sorry, I should say Kelprey along with other partners, so Amcrete and DB Group. Martin, can you? They call it zero cement. It's not really though, is it?
Well, my understanding is it doesn't have any Portland cement in it. So you then introduce some kind of binders. So it effectively ends up as a cemented material. Obviously, the main thing is it's got, in terms of embedded carbon, it's at a much, much lower level than a traditional concrete. So, it's got to be a good thing if we can start to use, alternative materials to those which contain, Portland cement. or OPCs.
Yeah, so Portland cement is when you burn coal and
lime.
Well,
you basically heat limestone, to a very high temperature. So that uses a lot of energy to actually, produce the binder that we have within concrete. Yeah. So from that point of view, if there are alternatives, it's a good thing to do. The problem at the moment, my understanding, is not necessarily whether the products exist or not. It's actually the codes and standards haven't caught up with it yet. So they're not actually permitted. So I believe at the moment there are relatively few projects where clients have allowed, these zero cement products in their structures because, I guess it all comes down to PI and insurance and compliance with building regulations. So I think the work
they're
doing...
There seems to be some conjecture around that. I've been in various meetings where they said, there is allowance if you look at this particular clause, but I think it probably comes down to performance as well in terms of whether, can you get the strength? Yes, probably, but not at 28 days.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about replacement cement products like GGBS, which is a result of the steel industry, isn't it? And the PFA is another replacement product. And the carbon's not produced when you're making that cement, as in ordinary Portland cement. It's a byproduct. Sorry. So yeah, the challenges are: can you get the strength at the required stage, and does it have the durability requirements? Yeah. So the cement and the concrete that was proposed by Bunchell et al. What products were involved in that?
I can't honestly say I know the details of the product, but effectively they're using an alternative binder material to ordinary Portland cement, and I'm not sure what additives they add to it, which effectively allows it to gain strength and harden.
I might be able to help here. I think it's pretty much 95% GGBS mix plus a 5% activator. It's a chemical reactor that of unknown origin, if you like, because that's a trade secret.
And when the Colonel's special recipe.
Well, it is, because if you use just GGBS, and I tried it on one of my projects in the many, many years ago, it just won't go off. It just won't go hard enough. So you need something to kickstart it, and hence why we use normally cement. So when I did my trials many years ago, we discovered that we needed about 100 kgs of cement in it just to get it the temperature up to get it to cure. So this is replacing the 100 kg from my experience in the past, this activator. It does the same process. It makes the GGBS react and develop, which means that it then can become a cementitious, or it is a cementitious material, but it can become a concrete as we know it.
Okay, so in terms of piles, I think there's a use for it, certainly in temporary works, but where you've got to be careful is how quick it's going off. So, for instance, for a retaining wall, if you're going to be digging out the earth in front of the retaining wall after, let's say, 2 weeks, then you're going to be concerned about whether the concrete will be hard enough. I guess for piles that might not be loaded, so bearing piles that might not be loaded for a year, then you've got an opportunity there. As long as you've got the information to say, yeah, it will reach that. It's a 365-day test result.
Well, it's all about time, isn't it? I mean, it's one of the reasons, I think, when we were talking about piling, we use piles rather than sitting pad fittings onto the gravels, is because it's about the speed at which you want to build things. And mm-hmm. that's why people like piles, because it usually gives you a time advantage. And I suppose if you've got more time on a project, then using a material that takes longer to gain strength is less of an issue. But I think you touched on it earlier as well, didn't you, Steve, about the durability of these materials. And I guess, quite often we're asked to sign up to a 50-year design life. Obviously, none of these products have really been around that long in lots of different ground conditions. And I think BRE has been doing some accelerated testing from a durability point of view. But I guess until people can be confident that their foundations will last, 40, 50, 60 years, in maybe aggressive ground, then it's still an unknown. So I guess everyone's going to be cautious until such time as you can be comfortable that the durability is there as well, and not just the strength in the short term.
That's right. Yeah, there is a lot of research going on at the moment, and lots of groups across the construction industry getting together to pool knowledge.
One important one to remember, though, when you talked about retaining wall, yes, maybe you can't dig out in front of the retaining wall 2 weeks after you've built it if you completely rely on the concrete strengths. But it might be a great opportunity to use it in the primaries where you don't ruin your augers and wreck it and you have a break, and you can still cut it after 4 weeks rather than in the same week. And it might change your sequencing, and it might change and drive cost efficiencies in the sequencing of the works when you can use it for the primary parts.
Yeah, well, while we're trying to learn the lessons, we're trying to understand the material, I think that is a good option. So the other paper that the Calpray team put together, this time in combination with City University, the University of London, was about the testing of hollow cast in situ board piles. I think, Martin, you've also taken a look at that particular document.
Yeah, I think it was quite a while ago, actually. Some initial tests were done by BBGE originally, where they worked with City. I think the main thing is that Calpray's probably taken it and commercialised it. And actually, I think they've used it in anger, shall we say. And I can see Yvonne's nodding ahead, so she probably knows a bit more about the history of it. But I think actually it's quite interesting when you look across the conference. There really weren't many new pile types that are sort of described. So it's good to see the hollow core pile being used. And, you know, and obviously there's been quite a lot of work done by City in the laboratory to understand its performance. And again, the fact that it's got a hollow core means that you're not putting lots of concrete in the ground that isn't really doing anything. So I guess, you know, this, if you're going to fill that hollow, or you're going to have a large pile that isn't stressed very highly, it probably brings you back to some of the lower strength concretes that we could, you know, we actually could be using. So there are clear benefits. I think it's like all piles. You know, you can't say there's a golden bullet that's going to work everywhere. There will be some situations where it's actually a very good solution, and others where, really it's not going to be that cost effective, or it will be slow to construct. But I think as a concept, it's actually good to see that it's out there.
This sort of idea has been trialled before. In fact, it's referenced within the paper itself. So BBGE or Stent, as it was then, had trialled something similar. I think they'd used a precast. It appears to be a metal section that's sunk into the board pile here to effectively create the formwork to pour the concrete around. So I think they'd used a slightly different approach. And at the time, it wasn't seen as being commercially viable, but things move on. The concrete price goes up. We've seen this year a really probably getting close to 20% increase in the concrete price. As that continues to rise, as it inevitably will, then this type of technique will become more cost effective.
Yeah, I think it was used. I think I went to a presentation in 2011. I think when the first hollow pile was presented, it just hasn't quite taken off, possibly due to the time it takes to construct, which offsets the benefits of less concrete and that sort of thing. So as Martin said, we build parts because we want to be quick in, quick out, and build on it. We don't appreciate things where we're tough.
Yeah, I mean, talking of research at City as well, is, you know, a new pile types. There was, I'm just trying to remember, it was a sort of a pile with imprints on the shaft. So there was a tool they introduced to effectively, you know, bore a conventional pile, but then introduce the sort of imprints on the pile shaft to improve the roughness. You know, and I remember my own experience with another company where we were putting in what we call a shaft enhancing, and it was all about the time it takes. You know, that was a big factor.
Yeah.
But similarly as well, it was also about, well, actually nobody, or very seldom did somebody, and I'm talking about developers here, were they prepared to take the risk of actually starting to pile a project? You know, that if it went wrong, what did it mean for their development? And this is always the challenge of introducing new products. You've got to be really sure it's going to work. And, you know, the risks are quite, well, maybe the risks in reality are quite low, but the perceived risks are very high.
Yeah.
You know, and even convincing the district surveyors can be a challenge when you want to do something slightly different if it doesn't fit within the normal guidelines.
I think because we're literally holding everything else up, the risks are perceived as being much bigger within the foundation industry of getting things wrong than any other part of the construction process. So it is understandable. And I think there will be a limitation in terms of the structural capacity. If you've got effectively got a void within the pile, you are lowering the structural capacity. So there'll be challenges there to overcome. So I'm not sure this is going to really see widespread use, but it just shows that there are alternative methods out there. I remember there was a pile, I can't remember the brand name of it, but it was creating a groove within the board pile, and the idea was that you would increase the effective diameter, or at least the shaft capacity of the pile, and it would be far more cost effective. And I thought, yeah, that's got something, but I've not seen that really used beyond that particular trial, which is a shame. But clearly there was limitations with that product as well.
I do think it's being used, but you have to face the problem that the construction industry is inherently conservative, and we don't like change. So I've not yet met anyone who readily embraces change and promotes it unless they have to. So if we want to drive innovation forward and we want to put more emphasis on innovation, then I think it needs to be top driven, because the industry itself can't change. People don't want to change because it's a bit comforting. You know, there's enough risk what you do when you think you know what you're doing to then develop something new. And it's very difficult to embrace that change. So, but I do remember in the early 2010s, is that what it is? And noughties?
The noughties, yeah.
When geothermal was leading to your next podcast again, geothermal piles were becoming mandatory nearly everywhere in London. Everybody wanted to build it because Boris said that we had to. So, and everybody was against it. And then we just built them and it wasn't as bad as we all made it out to be, but it was top driven, and suddenly it was possible. So I do think that if we want to promote innovation and get it through to insurers and everything else, we need some support. It can't be bottom up driven. We need a little bit of help top down.
I mean, it brings you back to the offshore industry, doesn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, the governments around the world have said, okay, we want to decarbonize. So they're actually incentivizing developers to go out and build, you know, wind farms and offshore. But, you know, there's huge costs involved. And we're also seeing the benefit that, you know, these things are happening. There's research going to try and refine it. But the government effectively is subsidizing the electricity until we get to a point that the market can sustain it. And maybe it's a shame that all the London developers don't get together to say, well, actually, we want to develop some new pile types. So there's a thought that you can start lobbying in the future to see if we can get them to fund some pile research.
That would be nice. Well, one area that we've already seen some advancement in is BIM. We're starting to see it in a few more projects now. And there was a paper by Gelder et al. About the use of BIM within a fairly complex flood defence scheme in Boston. And Martin, how did they use it, and how did the project benefit from the BIM model there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, what I understand is they really use 3D modelling to create an overall ground model. And then because this was essentially an upgrading of existing flood defences, so there were already flood defences there. So there was quite a complex arrangement of flood defences that were built over different times. And it was actually, how do you build around them and do that efficiently? And from what I recall from the paper, they created an existing model, both of the ground conditions and the existing structures. And then they looked at how could they install the upgraded flood defences. And I think there were six or seven locations that they demonstrated. And I think, you know, the real advantage of BIM here, and in particular understanding the paper, was the visualization made something that would have been incredibly complex to present as either 2D drawings or, you know, in text. It would have made it really difficult to understand what they've done and see the value of what they've done. So to me, it was about the presentation. So I actually really enjoyed looking at the graphics, seeing how they'd sort of threaded piles through existing, you know, tie backs and sheet pile walls. So it was really good from that point of view. But I think it also showed, you know, the level of capability we've got now in terms of this 3D modelling. And obviously, we know about 3D analysis as well. So but the fact that you can physically model these structures, I thought was great. And you know, but of course, we shouldn't forget BIM is not just about, you know, the visual side. It's also about how we capture the data. You know, the other side of BIM, and I know, you know, obviously through the FPS, we're trying to encourage the, you know, the capture of the right data, standard formats. You know, so the more the industry does, the better and will become our ability to sort of analyze complex problems and understand complex problems, you know, from a buildability point of view.
Yes, and I think one of the areas with BIM is service strikes. Unfortunately, we've not made huge progress in recent years around service strikes. We are still hitting far too many. I remember on my first jobs, not in piling, but in the construction industry, was as a setting out engineer on a water treatment works. And there were pipes everywhere of all different shapes and sizes. And then we were putting more in. I think if we can get a model that puts all of those together, it's going to really reduce the risks, the safety risks for people working on sites. So let's turn now to a topic that, I'm seeing more of. It's the piled rafts, which is a complex topic, but I think it's worth a discussion. I'm just glad I'm not the one trying to explain it to the audience. Yvonne, let's come to you. How did you get on with that?
Oh, brilliant. I think... Yes, we should do make more use of settlement reducing piles or using piles as settlement reducing elements. Now, one aspect of the paper by Gaspari, Crilly and Higgins is what they're discussing is how the piles have been used to reduce the settlement of the overall structure in the way that the piles have been designed not in a conventional way, as in with the relevant factors of safety or partial factors in accordance with the Eurocode, but effectively what used to be termed SSLS, as in with a factor of safety of one. So, which means that the piles then will settle, and that creates the interaction between the piles and the raft, and to optimize the system. Now, again, for me, this is... isn't so novel in its idea. It's quite hard to calculate, and there's a lot of iterations that you've got to jump through. So it doesn't lead to a quick design. So with everything being driven by time and program, it's very difficult to find sufficient time to analyze it, because there's a lot of iterations to be done. But I, for one, was glad that this method existed. A few years back when I had to pile something and had pile test failures, similar to the one we had, and we had to effectively make the raft take part of the load that the piles weren't able to carry. So it does have its benefit. It does drive better designs. And with the expectation of going down to net zero by 2050, we need to come up with different ways of doing the same thing, but just looking at it differently. Yes, there is more work up front between designers, and there's more responsibilities being shared between various elements. But the key message is you can get it to work. And if we look at it holistically, you get a better outcome.
Yeah, it needs a lot of iterations between the structural and the geo team, doesn't it, to try and understand how these piles are going to perform. So you're not designing them in the conventional way of looking at the ultimate capacity and applying a factor of safety. You're trying to understand, well, how much is that going to settle? In fact, the process is design effectively a slab or raft without any piles, and then see how much it would settle. Then put these things in to hold it up a bit, to counteract some of the movement, and then feed that back into the model, and then adjust the pile lengths again, and until it all balances up. But ultimately, what you end up with is smaller piles, and the raft taking more of the load. Where I've seen it in use is in basement construction, where you're going on to a gravel layer at, let's say, 3 or 4 meters on your underside of your basement slab, and there's piles that have been installed under that. So you're really taking the benefit of the bearing capacity of the gravels, the raft slab set on the gravels, and not having to make the piles work quite so hard. But because you understand how that combined structure is going to perform at working load, and you've done that greater amount of analysis, you can come up with a far more efficient design. So I really like the method, and it's going to put more emphasis on the engineering, which is fantastic as an engineer. And keep an eye out for that in the future.
But I also think that part of this process of how to design this, it would be useful for the reuse of foundations. So we talked previously about the it's easy to engineer solutions, but we don't just have to sell it to engineers. We have to also sell it to clients, to owners, and to insurers as well. So with the reuse of foundations, we sometimes struggle. We can perfectly justify the solution to engineers, but insurers just aren't interested. So, and if we look at projects where we have existing piles in the ground, if we treat them not as piles, but just as stiffer columns, and have then not a pile draft, as in this example, but a ground improvement scheme where we improve it with stiffness ratios, that might be also something that I think, or I would like to see more common, rather than ripping piles out and drilling through them, or putting piles adjacent to it and just avoiding it. I'd like to see a lot more use being made of existing structures in the drive to net zero.
And I mean, Yvonne, a question on that. I'm with you on that, but isn't one of the big problems just the lack of good quality information? So, you know, if you're going to rely on it, I mean, there were a few papers about that as well, weren't there? So
there was, yeah. Yes. I think that is crucial, because people might say, well, do an integrity test to try and determine. It's not really the most reliable form of trying to determine the pile depth, really. You need the construction records, not trying to derive it from test data.
And there was a paper by Henry Taylor from Arabs that discussed the reuse of piles, but lucky they had all the data that all other engineers ever dream of and put on their wish list available in the Arab archives. So yes, it does go to show, if you keep your records and your house tidy, you stand a much better or a clear advantage over anybody else to do the reuse of foundations. But I think even without, or with limited information, not without any, but with limited information, we could do so much more than just to ignore that they're there, and just build more piles around them and just try to miss them. Because currently the most common thing I've come across is let's expose the pile tops, let's survey them, and then plonk our piles in between so that they just miss the existing piles. Now, if you're trying to build a very highly loaded structure, that might be the only solution. But often we would just replace with what is like for like, and just we have a new structure there. So surely, as engineers, we could be a bit cleverer there.
Well, these BIM models are really going to help in that regard. So
if somebody keeps them on a USB stick and doesn't lose it, yes.
We've not got much more time on this podcast to discuss other techniques, but I do want to draw attention to a couple of other techniques and papers that are out there. There was a really interesting one about the Pagliarodici, I think I pronounced that right, technique, which it means root piles. And it's basically how you get a network of piles that you can use underneath structures. And it's a different form of underpinning technique. So check that one out. There was a scheme in Knightsbridge that Keller, Wentworth Health and A Square Studio presented. And also the use of buttress piles, which so buttress piles are used within basement excavations as an alternative to having props. They support the props. But let's say you've got on plan an L-shaped retaining wall instead of a full box, and there's not a you're not able to span a temporary prop from one side of the excavation to the other. This is quite a good alternative and can help speed up the excavation. So the CGL paper from Slattery and Groves, it explains a bit more about the modelling techniques that they use to use buttress piles. Lastly, we're going to talk a little bit about temporary works designs for working platforms. So I think most people working within the piling industry are going to be familiar with the BRE method to design. There are two different, there's three papers there that are presented to look at different methods for designing working platforms, because I think there is a feeling within the industry that we tend to over design the working platforms when we use the BRE method. It's the BRE method has moved on the safety and probably the productivity of the industry significantly. So I support the document, and it's a robust approach, but it must be said that there are other, perhaps more complex techniques out there. The serial 1-2-3 one is mentioned. So this is the way that analyzes it is as a lateral shear approach, as opposed to just this vertical method for looking at the punch and shear of the rig on the platform design. So that was good. Also Tensar, who of course a GeoGrid manufacturer, presented an alternative for platform design that was quite interesting. And again, that can come up with more optimistic, is that the right term? Certainly
economical, I think.
Economical. That's a far better word, Martin, thank you. More economical design for working platforms. And personally, I think whatever you come up with, you want to supplement that with a testing regime. Preferably do some plate tests before you put down the mat.
Yeah.
And you can use that to economize the design, and then after.
Yeah. I'd sort of jump in there because I feel quite passionate about this. We often talk about testing the mat itself with a plate that's 450 thick, which is a lot less than the tracks that are loading it. But whenever there's a failure, it's very seldom the mat material, it's the subgrade. You know, so I'm always say the most important thing is to understand your subgrade, and often it's because it's a local soft spot. So the inspection and the testing is so much more important. And I think the other thing is the selection of materials for the mat material. You know, you've always got this compromise between, you know, are you using very good quality, well-sorted aggregates where you actually know that you've got a high friction angle, so it can be reliable, versus quite often, so we see quite poor material going into piling mats, you know, and I think, you know, the design is one thing, but are the parameters reliable, and how do you test, you know, the materials that are going into making up the platform and the subgrade?
Yeah, I quite often see high clay sand, clay content within the mat material, which, in the short term, it might help, but in the long term, the durability is compromised, and we see a real fall off. So, and of course, as we work with the machines and vehicles passing over, they will degrade. So it's important to continually assess and test the mat to make sure it's still sufficient for the loads that are going to be placed upon it. So there's options out there. Take a look at the papers and see if you can economise your designs.
I think one of the key considerations, though, Steve, is yes, papers, there will be methods of making it more economical, the platform design, i.e. thinner. But one of the things from practical point of view that I feel very strongly about is you specify, you design your pile mat to be 500 mils, say. There is already a 50 mil tolerance on that thickness for the contractor who installs it due to the size of the specification in accordance with the highways specification for earthworks. So your 500 mil platform might not be 500 mil. It might only be 470, might only be 460. And then give it a day of concrete in wet weather. And just see how much thickness you still have. And everyone who's worked on the field and measured their platform thickness after a week's working with no maintenance knows that there is another 100 mil gone. So suddenly your platform that was designed as 500 started off as, say, 470, and you've lost over the course of a week another 100 millimetres. We're talking about 370. So we have a real problem here. Yes, this all shouldn't happen. And yes, we should maintain the mat every day of every week. But there's human error in there as well. The surveyor might have not come. We might have forgotten about it. There might be an excavator driver who's still learning to scrape just nicely over the material and not take it off. It might have been that it has been wetter than expected and it's just sludge and somebody is looking after the safety of the site operators. So whilst I'm all for economic designs, I think that there needs to be a robustness within the design that allows for practical changes on site. And the variation of the tolerance of installation and the actual working on the platform needs to be accounted for.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground. There's a lot of papers we have mentioned. There's even more papers that we haven't mentioned so far. So please go and take a look at the proceedings. Yvonne, how can people get hold of the publication, and is it possible to actually watch the videos of the lectures that were presented at the conference?
So for people who have attended the Piling Conference, they can use the login that they've used to access the presentations to just re-watch them or watch the other sessions that they couldn't attend, because we had two sessions running in parallel. So you might want to choose to watch the other ones. So the recordings are there in the same format, you just as they were presented before. So all you need to do is click on the session that you want to attend, and then on the right-hand side, you will see a session recording play button. So you can watch them back. That's for people who have attended the Piling 2020 conference. This is currently not available for anyone who hasn't attended the conference, only for the delegates. With regards to the proceedings are available through the ICE library. So just as any other proceedings for any other conference papers or like Geotechnique, any journal papers, you can just look for Piling 2020 and you will get the complete proceedings on the ICE library, where you can pick individual papers, download them, and depending on your access rights, yeah, you may have to pay for them. Or through ICE Publishing, you can also purchase the hard copy, if you so wish. The BGA will make the papers to all BGA members available 1 year from now, free of charge. So as we have done with the Chalk 2018 papers, and that will be announced in the annual conference later on this year. But for 1 year, the ICE have got the rights to the papers, the copyrights.
Brilliant. And is there anything that, other than being able to meet in person, of course, you would have done differently?
Considering it was a virtual event, I think it was as good as I could have hoped for. We all missed the chat, the coffee, the beers on a night time, you know, the cakes in the afternoon, I don't know, the lunch breakouts and the gossiping. And I think that's what most people would say is the personal touch of being able to catch up with old friends is a bit that most people are craving. I don't think I would have done much different. Maybe I've done volunteer next time for holding a conference, because it's a lot of work.
It's a big task. You did a fantastic job. And what's next then? Have we got another topic coming up?
I think yes. So we have broken down in our two-year cycle. So the next one was planned to be in 2022, but considering that piling 2020 slipped into 2021, the next conference is now planned for 2023. And the topic is geo-resilience. So anything to do with how do we make the infrastructure or any assets resilient to climate change? How do we drive down carbon capture how do we drive down carbon use and make things better for the future in line with driving towards net zero?
Well, Yvonne, Martin, thank you so much for joining me and for the level of detail that you've been able to provide today. I'm sure our listeners will have thoroughly enjoyed it. Usually at this point I say get in touch with our guests to ask more questions. I think perhaps more appropriately on this particular occasion, actually have a look at the papers and get in touch with the authors to discuss them directly with the authors. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you're still listening, then I'm guessing that you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe so the next episode is there ready for you as soon as it's released. Also, please do tell a friend and it will help us build our community. If you're interested in sponsoring an episode, then get in touch with me, Steve Hadley, on LinkedIn or the marketing team at Ground Engineering Magazine. Hope to hear from some of you soon. Bye-bye.